From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Robert Stone discusses his new novel, Damascus Gate. It looks at religion, identity, and extremism by focusing on what's been called the Jerusalem syndrome, people who believe they've been called to Jerusalem by the Almighty, people who are often mentally ill and think they're the second coming of Jesus Christ. Also, we talk with screenwriter and director James Toback about his new film, Two Girls and a Guy. Toback says he wrote the film about a two-timing actor for Robert Downey Jr. Downey made the film in between rehab and prison, and his performance has received rave reviews. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Noor Rahm. Rescue workers have found 13 survivors of a plane crash last night in Peru's northern jungle. The plane carried 87 passengers, mostly Occidental Petroleum workers. Sharon Stevenson reports.
The Boeing 737 was carrying Occidental employees and subcontractors from the major jungle city of Iquitos to Occidental's main drilling base at the town of Andoas, near the Ecuadorian border. The plane was only 3 miles from the base when the control tower lost contact with the plane as it crashed. In a communique, Occidental announced that bad weather has prohibited them so far from bringing the victims of the crash out of the area, which is in thick jungle. Andoas is 225 miles from Iquitos, which is a main resupply point for the base. An Occidental spokesman said most employees are Peruvian, although there is no word on the nationality of the victims available. Rescue teams from the Andoas base, as well as Peruvian Air Force personnel, are on the scene. For NPR News, I'm Sharon Stevenson in Lima, Peru.
An Occidental spokesman later said there was one American on board. He has no information on his fate. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he might turn down a U.S. offer for peace talks in Washington next week if it means bowing to U.S. ultimatums. The invitation was issued by Secretary of State Madeleine Albright after 2 days of separate talks with Israeli and Palestinian leaders. Netanyahu told Israeli state radio he's ready to go, but not if he's told he has to accept conditions that are unacceptable. Albright said the meeting is contingent on the two sides resolving some interim matters, referring to U.S. proposals that Israel relinquish another 13% of West Bank land. Indonesian police today confronted rioters in North Sumatra. Demonstrators have been burning and looting cars for 3 days, protesting rising prices. From Jakarta, Patricia Noonan reports for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
Security forces fired warning shots and tear gas in an attempt to disperse rioters who were looting shops and setting fire to vehicles in Medan. Some rioters turned their anger against the city's ethnic Chinese, setting at least one Chinese-owned shop on fire. Indonesia's minority Chinese population is frequently the target of violence due to its dominance of local business. The riots developed out of peaceful demonstrations Saturday when students began protesting against President Suharto's announcement there would be no new political reform until his term in office ends in the year 2003. But a second announcement Monday that the government would remove a subsidy on fuel, causing an immediate 70% price hike, set off the violence. Analysts fear worsening civil unrest as Indonesia tries to stick to economic reform measures required by the International Monetary Fund as part of its $40 billion U.S. dollar bailout plan.
Patricia Noonan reporting for the CBC from Jakarta. On Wall Street this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 27 points at 91.20 in active trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index is down 2 points at 1862. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, after showing some early signs of strength, Wall Street seems to have slipped again a little at midday. NPR's Jack Spear says it's not for a lack of news that stocks are on the downside today.
Well, even before the opening bell rang in New York, hours before to be precise, Wall Street traders, as well as investors on the other side of the Atlantic, had a big deal to discuss. The news that German industrial giant Daimler-Benz, parent of Mercedes, and number three U.S. car company Chrysler are in merger discussions broke even before most U.S. investors had rolled out of bed. Though the two companies will only confirm talks are going on, such a deal has already been valued at roughly $35 billion. Also moving the market today, a report from the Commerce Department that orders to the nation's factories rose 0.3% in March. That was mostly on increased demand for computers and other electronic goods. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
AT&T and the internet media company Excite Incorporated announced today a joint venture. They'll launch a new online service called Excite Online, powered by AT&T WorldNet Service. It will rival a similar service run by MCI and Yahoo Incorporated. It will begin in June. This is the second major internet deal this week for both companies. Yesterday, Excite and Netscape Communications agreed to collaborate on internet content and search services. And Monday, AT&T and Lycos Incorporated announced a plan to web-based consumer communication services. Stocks in Tokyo closed sharply lower today, with the Nikkei average down 357 points, or 2.29%. Recapping stocks on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 27 points at 91.20 in active trading. The Nasdaq is down 2. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As Israel celebrates its 50th birthday and Madeleine Albright tries to prevent the peace process from falling apart, Robert Stone takes a novelist's approach to the conflict in his new book, Damascus Gate. Stone is perhaps best known for his novel Dog Soldiers, which was adapted into the film Who'll Stop the Rain. His new novel is about a freelance journalist who wants to write about the conflict in Jerusalem, but instead of taking the political approach, tracking incidents of revenge and counterterrorism, he chooses what he thinks will be an easier story. He follows the people in cult groups and on the religious fringe. But through following them, he's led into just the kind of dangerous story he thought he was avoiding, a plot to blow up a Muslim holy place. Many of the people this journalist has been following suffer from what has been called the Jerusalem Syndrome.
In the Jerusalem Syndrome, as it's defined, foreigners, usually Western Christians, not exclusively, come to Jerusalem and are moved to believe that they've been brought to Jerusalem for some cosmic purpose, to bring about divine intention. And or else they come to believe that they are some divine or saintly personage. And you can see them on the streets of Jerusalem in their impersonations, wild-eyed and calling out. There's a special squad of the Jerusalem police which is charged with dealing with them. There's a special hospital, Kfar Shaul, where such people are confined and dealt with until they can be sort of shipped home.
So these are people who are living in the delusion that they're the second coming of Jesus Christ, or they're a saint, or another prophet from the Bible.
The second coming of Christ is a common one, but there was recently, I was told, a Samson. A friend of mine went by the hospital. I just talked on the phone to him, and he told me he stopped by the hospital and asked the psychiatrist who coined the term, "Who have you got today?" And the psychiatrist said, "Well, just a minute, I'll check." But that day they had no famous figures from the past. The worst time they'd had was with Samson, who was in fact pretty strong. but more commonly, it's Jesus Christ.
Were you interested in trying to find where that line is between deep religious conviction and seriously disturbed religious delusion?
I don't know that there is a line. I think, or if there is, the one person who's defined it best perhaps is William James, who talks about being twice born. Being deluded about religion is like being deluded about anything else. It's an obsession. It's an obsessive disorder. I mean, to speak of it clinically, it's an obsessive disorder, and one can collect stamps and in a perfectly rational manner, and then one can collect stamps in a totally deluded and frenzied and obsessed manner. So in some ways, it's not different from anything else. As long as somebody really has a grip on reality, no matter how emotionally they may feel, you can't say that they're deluded. The question essentially is whether their hold on reality is lost or not. Now, millions of Christians believe that the world is going to come to an end fairly soon, and the Messiah is going to return in their view. And according to whether they are premillenarian or postmillenarian, there will be the reign of Christ on earth, and there will be of 1,000 years, and there will be a war between the forces of good and the forces of evil. All this to the rational humanist sounds pretty far out, but the people who believe it aren't crazy. I mean, they're not deluded. When it doesn't happen, if it doesn't happen, presuming that it isn't going to happen, they will simply adjust their belief system accordingly.
Not everyone in your novel who has come to Jerusalem thinks that they're the second coming. I mean, a lot of people are there for many different reasons. In your novel, some are political activists, some are seekers of one sort or another. Many of the people in the book derive their identity from their religion. Their religion just kind of defines who they are and what they want from life. Where did your interest in identity and religion as a source of identity come from? Is this a recent interest for you?
It's not a recent interest. I mean, my characters tend to be, the characters in all my books tend to be shallow-rooted, transient, of loosely defined identity, looking for their connections to the world, looking for their connections with each other. So that, in a way, Jerusalem is a town I would naturally be attracted to, because it's so much about identity. And Jerusalem, in a way, is ruled by texts. It's ruled by people's interpretation of who they are and what they're doing is conditioned by this narrative that they attach to, that they embrace. And it's always seemed to me that I felt a sort of loose attachment to my story, that I always wanted to change my story.
Your personal story.
My personal story. I always felt that wherever authenticity resided, it was somewhere else. If I grew up in New York, then authenticity must be in San Francisco. It had to be where I wasn't. But I wanted it. I wanted to pursue it. Nevertheless, when I got there, authenticity had fled. It was somewhere else. But wherever it was, I wasn't carrying it around. My connection with circumstances seemed ephemeral. I could never really see what connected me to things exactly. And I kept my whole life, in a way, inquiring into the nature of connections between people, connections between place and people.
Not to get sidetracked too much here, but do you think one of the reasons why you're so interested in connection is because you spent 4 years of your early life in an orphanage while your mother was institutionalized for schizophrenia?
Yes, that is certainly one of the reasons. I mean, the first thing you have to do if you're brought up by schizophrenic is you have to decide what's real and what's not. Because if you're a small child and you're in the custody of a schizophrenic person, they're hearing things and they're concerned with things, very concerned, agitated over things that, as far as you can tell, aren't going on. And so you have to break down the difference between what's happening and what's not. What concerns you is what's happening, and what's not happening, whether it agitates your mother or not, it doesn't concern you. That's mom. I mean, she's doing her mom thing, and this has nothing to do with me. I mean, but this is, of course, a separation. It creates a gulf. You really are addressing your parent across a gulf, and this gives you a hunger, I think, for their presence.
Did your mother have religious hallucinations?
My mother did not have religious hallucinations. They didn't take a religious form. She really was not a religious person. She was really something of an intellectual. She was a New York City school teacher, and she finally lost her job for being too obviously crazy. But her delusions were sometimes extremely petty and not worth paying attention to. Rarely did they have any large-scale concerns. I mean, her way of being crazy was not particularly interesting. I mean, she wasn't concerned with plots to rule the world. She was more concerned with what they were up to in the next room, in the next apartment, or in the one below. It wasn't a very lyrical kind of madness, but it was something that took her away that I couldn't understand, but of course I grew up to it, so I had to make sense of it for myself.
Does this give you a sense of connection with people who are mad, whether it's a religious delusion that they have or another form?
Yes, I can relate. I think I can relate to certain conditions, psychological conditions, very, very readily, and I can also recognize them. There are a lot of people on the street suffering from various kinds of psychological stress, some of it clinical, some of it not, and I can usually recognize it. It's familiar to me from the range of my mother's repertory.
My guest is Robert Stone, author of the new novel Damascus Gate. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Robert Stone, author of the new novel Damascus Gate. I'm wondering what other forms of extremism you were exposed to during the time that you spent in Jerusalem.
Well, I was seeing the Intifada, and at that time, one of the things that was going on every day was the Israeli army and the border police making a show of strength, and the Shabab, the young Palestinian youth, making a show of strength on their part, enforcing strikes on the merchants of the city. So you had an air of intense contentiousness and a great air of kind of strutting and saber rattling and antler rattling, if you like. But mainly what we saw was an exchange of threats, a constant battle for the upper hand. And what was at stake here was the stones of the city. I mean, the city which the Palestinians were claiming as home, the stones which the Israelis were claiming as Jews, the absence from which was the central part of their identity, something that they were brought up to lament, to the place where they would be next year for century after century, and now they were finally there, and they were not about to give it up.
As someone who really understands the importance of story, did you find it particularly interesting to talk to Jews, Christians, and Muslims and hear their different sides of their story of Jerusalem, and also to talk to Arabs and Israelis, to Palestinians and Israelis, and get their different sense of the meaning of Jerusalem?
I got a lot of that. I was always trying to carry water on both shoulders. I was going to dinner on opposite sides of town, or on one side of town, having spent the day on the other side of town, bringing back what I thought were agreeable stories from that side of town. But my agreeable stories never seemed to go over. But people, for example, believed the people farthest from power were the Palestinians, and they believed rumor, as people far from power will do. They tended to believe all sorts of rumors that Salman Rushdie was coming to the city, that Woody Allen had been in town and was protesting the behavior of the border police. All kinds of unlikely things were believed on the Palestinian side of town because communications were less advanced.
Were you able to get people to see you as a neutral party, which is, I guess, the way you wanted to be seen?
That was the way I wanted to be seen. That was the way I felt. Although I felt different ways at different times, I think so. I think people accepted my basic goodwill. I mean, I think I wanted more than neutrality. I wanted, I wanted to be everybody's pal.
Somehow I get this feeling that you've been to San Francisco in the 60s, Vietnam in the 60s, and Jerusalem in the 90s, and found some very, very similar themes in all three places. Seekers, misfits, drug use, drug abuse.
Well, I think, I've pursued those things to some extent. It's not that I've gone where I expected to find drug abuse and alienated people. But let me put it this way. I mean, if you ask me what attracted me to Jerusalem, it was first the beauty of the city. And then as I got to know the city better, I saw that around the basic contention between Palestinians and Israelis, there had grown up this milieu, the kind of milieu that grows up around all the fever points in the world, of young people, young and not so young people, journalists, international social workers, UN officials, this entire milieu of people who socialize together, who work together, take risks together, party together. Some of the people working in the Gaza Strip and on the West Bank had just come from Eritrea and from Somalia. Some of them had been to every famine and every war since Vietnam. Many of them had a history of traveling from Cambodia to the Caprivi Strip to Eritrea. The young women would decorate their legs with henna in the manner of Somali women. I mean, sometimes they would party all night. Sometimes they would stay up 36 hours at a time. They all tended to be tempted to causes. They were idealistic and adventurous. These people, I think, to a novelist, are irresistible. And these were the kind of people I was seeing in Jerusalem. They were the kind of people I had seen in Vietnam and in Central America, following wars, following emergencies, doing good, and also following their own personal obsessions. And I ended up there, too, was not surprising.
And where do you fit into that milieu? I mean, you've been a traveler all your life. You left high school at the age of 17. You were in the Merchant Marines, the Navies. You did a voyage to Antarctica. You've done a lot of traveling in your time.
Right. Well, I don't fit in anywhere. I have no...
You don't fit in anywhere, is that what you said?
No. And no more.
Even
more
with
than,
the people who don't fit in anywhere.
Well, no, there are people nobody would tend to question, what is he doing here? Because nobody exactly knows what they're doing here in any of these given places. It's true. I don't fit in even with the people who don't fit in, in terms of a task. I mean, I try to make myself useful. In one way or another when I'm in such places. But as often as not, I spend my time trying to stay out of the way.
Did writing Damascus Gate take you any places psychologically that you hadn't been before?
I had to really... yes. For one place it took me was into the Lurianic Kabbalah, which I found to be an absolutely sublime religious vision.
This is a Jewish mystical text.
It's a Jewish mystical text, and it's partly on Kabbalah that my characters, some of whom are involved in this syncretic heresy, draw upon. They draw upon Kabbalah for their doctrine. And, of course, I had to read a great deal about it, familiarize myself with it. It's mostly been written about by Gerson Scholem. And I found that entire concept of the absconded God accorded perfectly with everything I felt myself, and even with what Nietzsche has written, what the 20th century theologians have written about the Deus absconditus, that feeling of the God we couldn't get at. In that doctrine, God has absented himself in order to allow the universe to exist. But he's left these shards of light that have somehow to be gathered together and put together, and the balance restored. And possibly then he will come back to us. And I find this not only sublime, but also tremendously appealing in a personal way. And perhaps it reminds me of trying to get at my mother when I was a very small child. I don't know. Perhaps it reminds me of everything I felt about not belonging in any one place or to any one group of people. In any case, it's a beautiful and breathtaking vision of things.
Does that mean that you're continuing to pursue studying Kabbalah?
No.
You got what you got.
I don't think I will. I mean, I take the question as meaning, will I somehow commit?
Right. Because, yeah, I guess maybe that's what the question was. Yeah.
Right. Uh-huh. But I decline to commit. I have always declined to commit. I'm going to keep writing as long as I can. But at this point, I will not commit.
Robert Stone, his new novel is called Damascus Gate. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with Robert Stone about how his own experiences with psychedelic drugs affected his writing about seekers and drug users. And film director James Toback tells us about his new film, Two Girls and a Guy, which he wrote for actor Robert Downey Jr. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert Stone. His new novel, Damascus Gate, is set in Jerusalem. It's about an American freelance journalist who's writing about people who have been drawn to Jerusalem by the delusion that they're the Second Coming or that they're the incarnation of a biblical figure. Stone is also the author of Dog Soldiers, about a veteran who started using hard drugs in Vietnam and is now entangled with dangerous drug dealers. Sometime in the mid-60s, I guess, you were in the San Francisco area. You were one of Ken Kesey's Merry Pranksters in the early experimentation with psychedelia. And for a lot of people, the early psychedelics brought on an enhanced sense of the mystical qualities of the world. And it was a kind of like deeply secular, spiritual experience for a lot of people. And I'm wondering what those encounters with psychedelics did to your sense of religion or
Well, my psychedelic experiences were religious. On acid, I absolutely believed that there was a God, although it wasn't the God that I'd been brought up to believe in. It was a supreme being, and I felt totally certain of it, But I was never able to take that much beyond the trip. I think there's something in there. I think there's something imprinted inside us that makes us somehow fashion a supreme entity. It's somehow in our primary process that we look out for some supreme entity. I think that's why it appears in states like the acid state.
You wrote an article that I quite like a few years ago about reading on the road for the first time when you were on the road. I mean, you were actually at sea.
Right.
You were on this voyage to Antarctica to continue the work of Admiral Byrd, who had died shortly before this trip. And you read on the road and so identified with this book. And then 10 years later, you met Neil Cassady, who is the real-life character that one of the main characters in On the Road is based on, and he was one of the people involved with Ken Kesey's group. Everybody was experimenting with psychedelics, and you became part of that group. And once you actually met Neil Cassady, he didn't compare that well in a way to the character in the book. What were the differences between reading the book and reading about this heroic character and actually meeting the person?
Well, it's always a bit of a disappointment, either to meet the writer of a book or a character from a book. Of course, it was 10 years later, but by then, Cassady, who is treated as the most hip, as the most perceptive, as the most eloquent, naturally eloquent cowboy hero in On the Road, was an irrepressible speed freak when I met him. I mean, he was mainlining methadrine, he was mainlining crystal meth, and he never ate and he never slept and he never shut up. And he went everywhere with this parrot called Rubiaco. And you'd walk into a room and someone would say, "The last time I was in Denver, those pigs had it out." And you turn around and you never knew whether it was going to be Cassady or the parrot. So Cassady was a bit of a trial. He had a hammer with which he practiced quick draw contests, and he was always trying to put acid in everybody's food. So if you didn't watch out, if you didn't watch what you were eating or drinking, you'd find yourself on an extended psychological adventure.
Which he would talk all the way through, no doubt.
Yes, where you'd be trapped with with Cassady and his parrot for 13 hours and. You wanted very much to avoid that, but I wasn't surprised to find myself there. But and I guess I knew enough not to be disappointed.
During the period when you were doing psychedelics in the 60s, early on when you were trying it and you didn't know what your reaction would be, were you worried, having witnessed your mother being kind of sick with the hallucinations of schizophrenia, were you worried about the dark side of hallucination and that it might sweep you away into a world in which you would be cut off from reality and perhaps not able to return again?
When I took my first trip, I thought that's exactly what I had done. I mean, there was no way I was not going to take that mescaline. We were all taking mescaline. We were going into town. John Coltrane was playing on Broadway. Lenny Bruce was also playing in San Francisco. We were getting together for a trip to the city. Everybody was taking mescaline. I was going to take that mescaline. Nothing was going to stop me. But once I'd taken it and it began to sweep over me, I immediately knew what I'd done. I'd put myself in the place that my mother lived, and then I would never, ever get out of it. But I seem to have.
Did you go back there?
Oh, I took lots of psychedelics after that for years. I mean, the last time.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I was going to say the last time was sometime in the 70s. I don't have the energy for anything like that anymore.
What got you to go back there after having this really frightening trip, which you thought you would be cut off forever from reality?
Well, I think the fact that I didn't get cut off, the fact that I lived to tell the tale and got back, made me think. I mean, it's one of the things you know, you keep doing it, and you think, oh, now I've gone too far, but you it clears up and you try it again because it's interesting and it's fun and of course it's dangerous.
Did you have good times on it too?
I had great times on it,
mm-hmm.
But nothing is free.
Right. What do you think the final... do you feel like there are consequences that you're still paying from having done that, or the opposite?
I think I took something away, something positive, something that I learned and that I use in my work, and I think I probably paid a price.
What do you think the price was? What you took away was insight, probably, right?
What I took away was insight and the relativeness of things. The price I paid is perhaps... a degree of confidence in the steadiness of the reality around me. I mean, I don't think I'll ever again trust reality not to turn itself into something unfamiliar and strange and grotesque. That's the price I pay. But what I took with me is useful.
I guess that's something you can work out through fiction, too.
Exactly. Yeah, right. I mean, that's where I work it out.
Right, right. Robert Stone, his new novel is called Damascus Gate. Coming up, screenwriter and director James Toback discusses his new movie, Two Girls and a Guy. This is Fresh Air. The new movie, Two Girls and a Guy, stars Robert Downey Jr. as an actor who has used his acting abilities to convince each of his two girlfriends that she is the only one. His girlfriends are played by Heather Graham and Natasha Gregson-Wagner, Natalie Wood's daughter. The two women accidentally meet and find out about each other. Then they decide to team up and confront their two-timing boyfriend with the truth. Two Girls and a Guy was written and directed by James Toback. Toback also directed Downey in the 1987 film The Pickup Artist, Downey's first leading role in a film. Toback's other movies include Fingers, Exposed, and The Big Bang. He wrote the screenplays for The Gambler and Bugsy. Robert Downey Jr.'s public image has been tarnished by drug abuse and a recent stay in prison, but his performance in Two Girls and a Guy has won rave reviews. He plays a compulsive performer, someone who's always on, even when he's alone in a room. Here he is calling his agent while seated at the piano.
De patris, amen, Mark.
It's Blake. What is it, like 4:30 there? Get up.
Cum sancto spirito.
So what happened with this job? Did I get it?
No.
Why, too talented as usual? What's going on? There's all these blowhards working. I can't get a job. So what else? What about, like, anything? What else
Really?
Wow. And that's in the Catskills, huh? God, you know, I know a lot of... No, actually, I don't know anyone who's made it in the Catskills. What are they paying me? Wow. Yeah, that'll cover the dry cleaning. What about like a TV spot or something? I can't even believe we're discussing this, John. This is ridiculous. It's like you don't know who you're dealing with here. And have you been drinking quite a bit again? I'm just kidding. I'm just a little. You know, hold on, let me think about it for a second. Call me daddy, bend over and then squeal like the pig that you are for offering me this yap. No, I'll take it.
James Toback, I think that Robert Downey was in between rehab and prison when you actually shot the movie with him. Tell me why you wanted to work with him, knowing the problems that he had had with drugs.
Well, I think that Downey's whole history had included drugs, obsession, addiction, so that it wasn't as if all of a sudden somebody who had been functioning smoothly and well picked up a habit which might change his reliability or affect his talent. I think different people handle things different ways, and I'm not suggesting that it's a good thing or a bad. I myself quit permanently any kind of pharmacological indulgence when I was 19 years old. But you take people as a whole, and Downey was and is a fascinating, complicated, talented, interesting guy who also was a friend.
The character that Robert Downey plays is someone who hasn't really made it as an actor. He's a struggling actor, but he's a born performer. And although we don't see how well he performs on stage, and we don't know if he's a very good actor on stage or not, we see him performing compulsively at home, performing in front of the mirror, performing on the telephone, performing in front of friends. He doesn't quit. And Downey is so much fun to watch in this role as this compulsive entertainer. What was well suited about this part for Downey, do you think?
Well, I wrote it for Downey. I took what was the essence of his nature, which is that of the charmer, the seducer, the entertainer, the verbally and physically facile enjoiner, and then worked into that a consummate layer of deception, which is also central to Downey and creates an interesting drama. And then in addition, felt from watching him after he'd been arrested and had gone into rehab a bit earlier, worked in this kind of dark and desperate side of his character, which I felt, having seen him on television after that arrest, he would be ready to reveal in a way that he hadn't before on screen.
I think this role kind of captures the self-absorption of a lot of artists, which ends up being both their strength and their weakness. Their strength is because they have this this inner talent to always draw on, but that self-absorption is their weakness too, because if you're friends or lovers with someone like that, you know, after a while it's, but enough about you. You know, enough performing, just relate to me as a person. And I think that really comes across in this movie, this, okay, you're a really fun performer, but stop already. Is that something you intentionally wanted to write in? Is that something you've seen a lot in either Downey or other actors?
Absolutely. I think it is central to the nature of most performers that I've met, and certainly central to Downey's being. Here and there you'll meet an actor who is fairly free of that, but not often. And the need to please, the need to be watched, appreciated, the need to fascinate, the need to delight. I think that is probably the deepest motivating force in most actors and in most entertainers, and it certainly is in Downey. I think in his case, he almost doesn't care whether the camera's running or not. He's running all the time.
Give me a sense of what it was like to work on an improvised scene with Robert Downey.
Well, in Two Girls and a Guy, towards the end of the movie, there is a scene in which secrets of the two girls are revealed. And those secrets emerge only after a final assault on Downey and his duplicity. It was the only scene in the movie, the writing of which I felt was unsatisfactory from the day we started shooting. And on the day we were shooting it, having not made the necessary adjustments myself, I approached Downey and suggested that, well, he actually said to me, you know, this scene isn't nearly as good as the rest of the movie. And I said, I know that. And I said, why don't you write something yourself that you like? And he went off for about an hour and came back with what was a rather self-serving passage, quite interesting and workable, but it was just kind of the beginning of a scene. And I said, well, this is good as a start. Let me show it to Heather and Natasha, Heather Graham and Natasha Wagner. And I showed it to Heather, who turned purple as she was reading it, and said, I would never let him get away with this. And I said, well, then don't. And she said, what do you mean, don't? I said, don't. Don't let him get away with it. Say whatever you want. Come back at him with whatever you want to come back with. And she said, really? I said, yeah. She said, you mean anything? Yeah, anything. Because up until then, the improvisation in the movie had been kind of riffs on what was written with certain parameters to be observed. And then I said to Natasha, and you're going to be there, and whatever you want to come in with, you come in with whatever. So by the time we started, we didn't rehearse it. We just sat down with three, with a whole array of mirrors. So it had a kind of very interesting fractured effect, splintered effect. And we got several different camera angles. And it actually was a fascinating scene to edit, because what I was left with then was 200 minutes of footage to cut into a 10-minute scene.
I want to ask you about another scene. I want to ask you about the scene that we opened the interview with, where Robert Downey is on the phone with his agent. How much of that was written? How much of that was improvised? Did you have him, like, singing on the phone as he put the agent on hold?
It was about half and half. The singing was his invention totally. Call me daddy, call me daddy. The pig that you are. That was Robert's invention. And for offering me this job, yeah, I'll take it. He has very, very good timing and good instincts about how to go off and how to come back. I mean, I'd worked with him on The Pickup Artist, as I said, 10 years ago, and there wasn't anything like that kind of confidence in his instincts then. And here, he just zoomed away every minute with what he instinctively felt was right and pretty much knew exactly when to come back, as in that scene where he kind of goes off and steps right back into the line of the scene.
Well, the premise of Two Girls and a Guy is that a man, played by Robert Downey, has told two women, played by Heather Graham and Natasha Wagner, that each of them is the only one he is capable of loving emotionally or physically. And, of course, each of these two women think they are the only one until they accidentally meet outside his loft. I personally think you finally let him off the hook. I won't give enough of the plot away to explain why I think, you know, how I think you let him off the hook. But I do think you did that. So
you mean let him off the hook in the sense that I justify his behavior?
Yeah, that you offer some kind of like emotional justification for his behavior.
I don't think so at all. I think that it's very clear that if the movie is taking a position, it's taking the position that the women take. I mean, I think their attack on him is so ferocious and so clear and so justified, until, of course, the twist at the end, which doesn't in any way mean that he has been right. It's just that there are complications in them too. But I think he is shredded in this movie. And I think that, you know, to suggest that this movie that justifies his behavior, when in fact it shows how it has devastated two people and been fundamentally dishonest. I mean, the fact that Downey happens to be very charming and engaging was, I think, a necessary component in the casting. If not, the audience would have wanted to stab the guy halfway through the movie. But I think the virtue of the movie is precisely the opposite of that. I think it makes it very clear that this is a guy who is a liar and is a deceiver and is not emotionally ready to face up to the consequences of his actions, that all he does when he's called on something is tell another lie and spin off into another deception. And in no way anywhere is there an authorial point of view that says this is a proper or an acceptable way to behave.
My guest is screenwriter and director James Toback. His new movie is called Two Girls and a Guy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
James Toback is my guest. He's the writer and director of the new movie, Two Girls and a Guy. I want to ask you about what has been, for obvious reasons, the most controversial scene in your movie, which is a sexual encounter between the character played by Heather Graham and the character played by Robert Downey. And this is a scene that the Motion Picture Association asked you to recut, or else they would have given you an NC-17, which would have seriously restricted your ability to advertise and to screen the movie. Tell me what you wanted out of this scene.
Well, the scene is was designed for the psychological intentions of the characters. And you almost have to have seen the movie. But what Heather Graham does at that moment, which is a bit cruel towards the other character, towards Natasha, is to seduce Downey, to pull Downey into the bedroom with the intention of getting him off and then of leaving. The second moment, the transition.
So this would be a way of like asserting her power over him. Or
that's right, and showing it to herself, to him, and to Natasha, and then leaving. Then, as she's trying to leave, he stops her from leaving. And at that point, he's on the spot, because obviously he's not going to get anywhere by simply showing that he's physically stronger than she is. So what he needs to do at that point is to get back to the point, which he certainly knows through a 10-month history with her, where he can excite her and get her off, which he then does. Then the coda is that she, in effect, recovers from having allowed that to happen and still leaves. And in effect says, even though you got that, that was a Pyrrhic victory, because I'm gone. Then, of course, she comes back. And the question, and I think it's one of those mysteries which is not only true in life, it's true in the film. You don't really know, and I don't really know. If she had just gotten him off and left, would she, as a character, have gone back? My suspicion is that she would not have.
So when you realized that your choices were NC-17 or recut the movie, was that a choice for you? Did you ever consider the NC-17?
Well, I didn't recut. I really just trimmed. I mean, I would have, ultimately, if you get bald about it, I would have had to do whatever I had to do to get an R. Fox Searchlight bought the movie and owned the movie and was not going to release it as an NC-17. So I had to get an R. And what I did was resubmit 14 times, each one with some shots a little shorter than they'd been before. I never actually took a shot out. I mean, given that they were going to take the position they took, I thought, what difference does it make if someone is exposed to the terrifying sight of this sexual act occurring for 7 seconds as opposed to 4 seconds?
We talked about casting Robert Downey in the movie, and in fact, writing the role for Robert Downey. I also want to ask you about casting Heather Graham. I think it's such an interesting contrast to her role in Boogie Nights. In Boogie Nights, she plays somebody who is, in her own way, really naive and not very smart outside of maybe a little street smart. And in your movie, she's somebody who has a lot of, you just imagine this character having a lot of depth, a lot of, she seems very self-contained, very smart, very focused. Tell me what you saw in her when you cast her. I think she's really a fine actress.
I think Heather's a great actress. I think she's a terrific personality, and she's very appealing and interesting and mercurial. She has a kind of surface beautiness with a quiet, subtle intelligence and a kind of natural goofiness, which work very well in combination because they're sort of it's a surprising mix. I talked to her with Downey for about 15 minutes, and I think we both knew that she could do it. We didn't read her. It was just that she was impossible to shock or offend. And
that part of the audition, trying to shock
and
offend her?
It was with her. It was actually with most. It wasn't so much trying to, as given the nature of this material and given the fact that we were going to be shooting for 11 days and that we were going to need actresses who could go wherever they wanted to go, wherever Downey wanted to go, wherever I wanted to go, we needed freewheeling people who were not easily upset or offended. It was just a practical decision. On a normal movie with a normal shooting schedule, that's I don't want to say irrelevant, but it's not a major consideration. In an 11-day shoot where you have to make use of every minute and you can't coddle people of delicate sensibility, and you're dealing with a movie that is dealing with kind of raw and dramatic personal and sexual issues and themes, it was essential to get people who could handle whatever came up. So it wasn't that it was a conscious plan, but I think both Downey and I felt that if we inhibited ourselves while talking to the people we were interviewing, it would not be doing them a service or us. And Heather, of all the people we talked to, responded as freely and openly and kind of one-upped us. So it was very clear off that 15 minutes that she was ready to handle anything that came up.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
James Toback wrote and directed the new film Two Girls and a Guy. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Monique Nazareth, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Alan Tu. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. And here's the Ray Charles version of the song that's kind of the theme song of Two Girls and a Guy.
You give your hand to me, then you say hello, and I can hardly speak. My heart is beating so, and anyone can tell. You think you know me well, but you don't know me.
No, you don't know me.
No, you don't know the one who dreams of you at night and longs to kiss your lips and longs to hold you tight. Oh, I'm just a friend, that's all I've ever been, 'cause you don't know me.
No, you don't know me.
For I never knew the art of making love, though my heart aches with love for you. Afraid and shy.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Netcom, internet access and web hosting solutions for small businesses. 1-888-NETCOM-3. This is NPR, National Public Radio.